your Bibles to this chapter of the story of Joseph that we read earlier in the service, Genesis chapter 39. And those of you who have accompanied with us Sunday evening by Sunday evening, as we have studied the ongoing story of Joseph, will have noticed, no doubt, that we have not read chapter 38. In which chapter the whole story is thoroughly unpleasant. We do not ignore chapter 38. We draw attention to it, but we do not read it in public. Now, this is not escapism, nor is it false modesty, nor is it any form of arbitrary censorship, as if I, off my own bat, were saying that certain chapters of the Bible should not be read in public. Drawing attention to this chapter, but not reading it in public, is wisdom. I do not need to tell you that there is a great deal that is being said and written and shown on our television screens about the sordid aspects of human life and behavior. And this is being done increasingly in a blatant way. It is being done crudely, and it is being done in the name of art and honesty. And when people who do these things, both the creators of the plays and the articles and the producers of them, when they are challenged, they say, "Ah, well, but you see, this is what life is like." And I agree. That is true. And therefore, we must face up to the facts of life, but we must never use the facts of life either to titillate or to find vicarious pleasure. Nor must we use any of the realistic facts of life, speaking of them in such a way, or dealing with them in such a way, that could possibly introduce people to things that they are best ignorant of. There are some things that are best not dealt with in public. And this is why I have not read Genesis chapter 38. The chapter gives us a very vivid, very unpleasant picture of the family situation of Judah, son of Jacob and elder brother of Joseph. The background of the chapter is the same as we find in the book of Ruth, the laws among the Jews with regard to what is called Levirate marriage. It's dealt with in Deuteronomy chapter 25 from verse 5 onwards. The law being this in Jewish society, that if a husband died and there were no children of that marriage, then the brother of the man who died was under obligation under the law of God to marry the widow in order to raise children that would bear her husband's name and carry forward that name and carry forward the property of the husband. And this was happening in the situation in Genesis chapter 38. And we are told there about one of the brothers whose name was Er. And all it says about him is that he was wicked, and God took his life from him. Very solemn. But God has absolute right so to do, because wicked people have a capacity for corrupting countless others. And here is one instance in which God said, enough was enough, and ere Judah's firstborn was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord slew him. The second brother of the man who had died, his name was Onan. And the chapter records, when it is rightly translated, that consistently and persistently, quite deliberately, in a calculated way, he refused to do right by God's law. And what he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord, and he also was removed from the face of the earth. And the focus of the chapter then turns to Judah, one of the elder brothers of Joseph. And the chapter records Judah's lack of morals. It describes a man who apparently lived for gratification, sensual gratification. A man who, according to verse 11 of chapter 38, a man who was deliberately deceitful. He had no intention whatever of giving his son to Tamar. When we go down to verse 23 of that chapter, we see a man with absolutely no conscience whatever regarding his own wrongdoing and his own disgraceful and open and deliberate immorality. Let her keep the things as her own, lest we be laughed at. Oh, he said, you see, let's keep it all quiet, because after all, I'm a public figure and I wouldn't like this kind of story to get out about me. But you know, God has a great capacity for getting stories out in the open, to the discomfiture of wrongdoers. We find, when we come to verse 24 of that 38th chapter, that this man, Judah, was a total hypocrite with regard to Tamar's sin. Your daughter-in-law has played the harlot. And Judah said, bring her out and what a wicked thing to do. She's got to pay the penalty. We can't allow this kind of thing in our society. What a hypocrite. But we need to be careful, lest we put ourselves in the position of those who cast the first stone. Because it's very easy to point the finger at other people's sins and conveniently forget our own. Yes, it's an unpleasant chapter. Yes, on the other hand, I know that Tamar and Perez, her son, are mentioned in the New Testament in Matthew chapter 1 and in Luke chapter 3 in the genealogy of our Lord Jesus Christ. Yes, I see from this story what we were singing about, the amazing sovereign grace of God that brought good out of evil. But that 38th chapter of the book of Genesis is a chapter that portrays for us a situation and an atmosphere you would and you should want to keep away from, especially if you want to serve God. It seems in that chapter that public opinion both accepted and excused Judah's behavior. And so it is now. And we begin to see, and this leads us on into chapter 39, we begin to see the great point and the wide significance and application of those words that we say so easily at times when we say together the Lord's Prayer. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. And this brings us back to the story of Joseph. Because as the story has developed, you know how his brother's anger and how they wanted to kill him, then they settled for selling him as a slave and they got rid of him that way. The truth of the matter is that Joseph, by the amazing grace and the sovereign providence of God, Joseph was removed from this atmosphere and this location of evil that we've just been describing. And Joseph was removed from that situation by radical and very unpleasant means. There was no real excuse for his brother's behavior, and yet God was in it. And Joseph was not only taken away from this vile atmosphere, and it was vile, Joseph was not only taken away from that atmosphere, he was kept away. He had no even if he wanted to go back home, he couldn't. He was a slave, he had no rights, he had no freedom. He was taken away and he was kept away. And we have to recognize that God was, in fact, protecting Joseph from danger in the interest of Joseph's future, Joseph's future service, and the future development of God's purposes. Of course, it is really quite alarming to think that the immoral behavior that we have been speaking about, the carelessness and the forgetfulness of God, were operating within the context of a family of people who had been chosen by God, called by God, and blessed by God. Dare I say it for the sake of emphasis? Don't take this as an accurate theological statement. But in the context of our study of these chapters, we are reading about something that was happening not outside in the big bad world, but inside within the life of the church. And that's a solemn thought. And what I'm saying to you tonight highlights the danger when a people, individual or congregational, when a people or a congregation are adrift from God. In a situation like that, that is usually marked and underlain by spiritual complacency, some are stronger than others, and therefore able to cope with more than others. But some are vulnerable, very vulnerable, and therefore the atmosphere of purity is absolutely vital. And of course, it is an atmosphere of purity that by and large has disappeared from our contemporary society. When we come into chapter 39 and read the story of Joseph under temptation, we see in Joseph a tremendous contrast with his elder brother Judah. We see in this young, healthy, handsome man, a man of faith, a man with a future in the purpose of God. We see in this young, healthy, handsome man the attitude that he was having nothing whatever of trifling with moral standards or moral behavior. And I found myself asking the question, as I read Joseph's story in chapter 39 and admire the young man, I found myself asking the question, would Joseph have been able to resist this kind of temptation if he had still been in that ugly, unhealthy atmosphere of his home situation? I ask the question, I do not answer it. But I ask you to consider Joseph here in chapter 39 and to see the change in him compared to what we read in chapter 37. In chapter 37, we see Joseph. It's not, I suppose it's not totally appropriate for a fellow who was 17 going 18 years of age. We see him as a spoiled brat. We see him as a self-important young man. We see him as a young man spiritually arrogant. He knew it all. After all, God had spoken to him. Well, we know the result of these attitudes. But now we see Joseph, a man of character and a man of faith and a man of capacity. And he's still young. If you look in our chapter for tonight at verses 2 and 3, the Lord was with Joseph. I suppose we could say that God liked Joseph's company. After all, it says in the Bible, can two walk together except to be agreed? The Lord was with Joseph. And he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master, who was an Egyptian, no doubt an idolater, his master saw that the Lord was with Joseph. Potiphar watched Joseph and said, well, there's a fellow who has a God who is real. There's a fellow who believes in his God and trusts his God. And he's got a God who trusts him and blesses him. It was obvious. And Potiphar saw that the Lord caused all that Joseph did to prosper in his hands. And the house of the Egyptian was blessed because of Joseph. But I cause you to think back again to chapter 37. Joseph wasn't a blessing and hadn't been a blessing in his own home and amongst his own family. As I said last week, he had been a pain in the neck. He was a disturber of the peace. He was a creator of disharmony. He wasn't a blessing. But now, he has blessed himself, and he is a blessing to others. Oh, you say, what a change. Yes. And it's great to see it. But we have to remember the time scale. This didn't happen overnight. And we have to remember his experience in the pit and being sold to the Midianites and the journey in the slave train. You've seen pictures, no doubt, in television and in books of the old slavery days on the continent of Africa, where you saw great long lines of slaves with things round their neck, fastening them to the next person and the next person, and the slave drivers with their whips, and the suffering and the misery and the humiliation and all that kind of thing. Well, Joseph went through all that, and he went to the slave market. I don't know whether he was sold at the first auction or not. Maybe nobody bid for him at the first auction. How do you feel it would be like to stand on a pedestal of some kind and have somebody pointing out the various good aspects of your physique and all the rest? And what am I bid for this specimen? Perhaps the best way to describe or to show you what it cost Joseph is to refer you to Psalm 105. Verse 16 to 19. Listen to this. This is rehearsing the story. When God summoned a famine on the land and broke every staff of bread, he had sent a man ahead of them, that is ahead of the children of Israel, into Egypt, Joseph, who was sold as a slave. His feet were hurt with fetters. His neck was put in a collar of iron until what he had said came to pass. The word of the Lord tested him. That's pretty grim, isn't it? And he was alone in these experiences. And these experiences can only be described as the refining fire or the furnace of affliction, whereby the human and spiritual dross was purged out of Joseph's character and life to make him a man of use to God. I have a list of references here, but I just feel that I can't make you turn them all up tonight. One of the references I've got is from Romans chapter 5, where after the wonderful opening verses we read, tribulation works patience and experience hope. Oh, says Paul, writing in the context of the glorious gospel, the trials and the tribulations forge character in you. You have the same kind of thing in the first verse of the epistle of James, and I'm reading it from the translation by J.B. Phillips. When all kinds of trials and temptations come crowding into your life, don't resent them as intruders, but welcome them as friends. Realize they come to test your faith and to produce in you the quality of endurance. But then you see in Joseph's story, as we read about it in chapter 39 of Genesis, this process of refining and fashioning and making Joseph a trusted instrument in the hand of God, this process was only beginning. But the very fact that Joseph was learning, there's no doubt he was learning, but the very fact that he was learning made him a target for Satan. When we studied there last Sunday evening, chapter 37, we spoke about Joseph's spiritual pride and likened him to Peter in the Gospels. And we reminded ourselves of the words of Jesus to Peter, Simon, Satan has desired to have you. Oh, I wonder how many Christians, perhaps of maturer years here tonight, can look back on occasions in their lives and say, yes, I wasn't really aware of it then, but I see it now. Satan desired to have me to abort the purposes of God for me. But Jesus said to Peter, but I have prayed for you. Isn't that a comfort? What a prayer partner to have. But now in chapter 39 we find Satan back again at Joseph with persistence, putting on the pressure through this wicked married woman. Now Joseph, verse 6, was handsome and good looking, and after a time his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph. You have to think of the story of the process, where no doubt to begin with, she just always seemed to be around when Joseph was carrying out his duties. No doubt paying him compliments. You're a great worker, Joseph. Oh, my husband was telling me last night just how much he thinks about you, Joseph. The flattery of the devil. Is after a time his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph and said, lie with me. But he refused and said to his master's wife, lo, having me, my master has no concern about anything in the house, and he has put everything that he has in my hand. He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except yourself, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? Ah, you see, he's a much more spiritually minded man than he used to be. And there is no doubt at all that our awareness of God and our looking to God and our commitment to God is one of the great powers in resisting temptation. And although she spoke to Joseph day after day, he would not listen to her to lie with her, and I've underlined in my Bible, or to be with her. You can imagine her, wicked woman that she was, scheming woman that she was. Well, Joseph, I'm sorry for what I suggested, but at least we can be friends. We can still go on seeing each other. Joseph said, madam, not on your life. He wouldn't be near her. But as I said, Joseph is now fixed upon God. His sufferings and his humiliation had given him a new sense of values and a new respect for people. He had precious little real respect for his brothers back home. But he has a respect now for Potiphar. And he stood his ground. No doubt having, to put it in New Testament language, no doubt having put on the whole armor of God. And then, verses 11 and 12. One day, he just happened to go into the house in the pursuance of his duties, and everybody else was away, but she was there. I've written down in my bit of paper, your adversary, the devil, seeks which one of you he may devour. Young folk and older folk, there's a devil. See to it that you're not in the wrong place. And in these verses 11 and 12, it would appear that Joseph was taken unawares. Earlier on in the series of temptations, he stood his ground. But this time he didn't stand. He took to his heels and he ran. And there are times, my good people, that as soon as you realize there is danger, get out. Never mind what anyone thinks. As I prepared my sermon and was writing my sermon notes, my mind went back quite a number of years now, more years than you care to count, in the Glasgow situation. And one of our own young men training for the ministry had been invited by friends to a party. He told me about it. And he went to that house in all innocence. But almost as soon as he got in, he realized that the party was a wife-swapping party. And he was out the door like a bullet out of a gun. And when he told me, I said, good. That was the right thing to do, and that's what Joseph did. He turned and he fled. Now, I recognize that there are times when a Christian in a certain situation can, in fact, stop the tide of evil. There are times when the presence of a Christian puts a restraint upon the operations of evil. And there will be those subsequently who will thank you for being there. But in order to have that kind of influence, you need not only to be right with God, you need to be strong in the Lord. And by and large, the thing to do most of these occasions is to get out, and to get out as quickly as possible. And that's what Joseph did. But of course, the devil being foiled, the devil was angry. And the next development in the story is the anger of the devil. I'm not quoting the saying rightly. I've checked up in the dictionary of quotations. But the way it is usually quoted is simply, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. And that's what we're reading about here. The wicked lying of this woman to the other servants when they appeared and to her husband when he got home. And Joseph ended up in prison. His reputation, well, Potiphar's wife would see to it that his reputation was as blackened as could possibly be. Oh, you say, how unfair. Yes. What a disaster. No. Joseph was imprisoned. The normal procedure in a situation like this would be, without any questions being asked, Joseph should have been executed. Just like that. But he wasn't. As I pointed out when I read the scriptures in verse 19, it says, when his master heard the words which his wife spoke to him, this is the way your servant treated me. I think we should put emphasis on your. This is the way your servant treated me. I wouldn't have had him in the house. There was anti-Semitism even in these days, you see. His anger was kindled. And I raised the question, anger with whom? With Joseph? Or with his wife? I find it quite interesting, perhaps even significant, that Potiphar took him and put him into the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. It was the VIP prison. It wasn't the common prison with all its degradation, and there were plenty of prisons like that in Egypt. Joseph was kept among the king's prisoners. Have you cottoned on to the significance? What about the story as it goes on? Who ended up in the same jail as Joseph? Two of the king's servants. Remember? And eventually, as a result of that, Joseph is brought out of prison, not to Potiphar's house, but to the king's palace. It proved to be significant. We're always far too quick to assess situations on a superficial level. This wasn't a disaster. It was going to prove significant. And as I have said so often, the king's prison was the one place of safe custody in Egypt where that wicked woman could not get hold of Joseph. She could do him no harm. But you remember what we read in Psalm 105 of how God sent his man in advance. And so Joseph is being set in the place where he will be prepared and be ready for what God needed him for in days to come. But of course, prison is prison. And for the second time, Joseph is brought to shame and humiliation. First of all, in his own home, at the hand of his brothers. And now, again brought to shame and humiliation, brought down there from the place of favor in Potiphar's house. Don't minimize the cost. The men and women in Scripture that God has used weren't machines. They weren't superhuman. And neither was Joseph. And when I say don't minimize the cost, can we perhaps, as we close, think of Joseph going through a season of reaction? It's not easy having been confronted by the devil and having made your escape and ended up, as it were, in prison with everything, when everything seemingly was going well and it all crashed to the ground. Can you think of Joseph going through a season of reaction? Can you imagine him shaken in his feelings? Have you ever known what it is to be just at the very brink of yielding to terrible temptation? And God in his amazing grace has brought you back. Have you known what it is to shake in your feelings? Can you imagine Joseph in prison with surges of doubt? But what does it all mean? Have I really failed God? Have I messed it all up again? Can you imagine Joseph saying, where is God in all this? But gradually, as time went by and Joseph calmed down, and he was still saying, where is God in all this? I think perhaps he heard a wee whisper. Joseph, I'm here. God was there. Verse 21 of our chapter. But the Lord was with Joseph. Can you imagine Joseph's feelings as he began to realize he wasn't abandoned? He wasn't given up. God, God wasn't angry with him. The Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's care all the... Have you noticed in these stories how everybody trusted Joseph? I don't know that anybody really believed the slanders of that wicked woman. And of course, if she was aware of that, that would just make her all the more furious. But the Lord was with Joseph. The Lord was with Joseph, and whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. You can imagine some of the other very important prisoners saying to Joseph, "How do you seem to get on so well?" And Joseph, "Well, it's not me. It's my God." And you can imagine Joseph bearing testimony to the king's prisoners of the God whose love was an everlasting love. The end of my sermon note simply says, how does all this fit in with God's future plans as indicated in Joseph's dreams? Well, at this stage, Joseph just couldn't see it. But God saw clearly. He always does. God hasn't to pray agonizing prayers about your future or my future. He's quite clear. He's got it all planned. And God was with Joseph. And God was really saying, Joseph, trust me. Sounds very simple, doesn't it? Trust me. I think in the hymn we're about to sing, we'll say, I am trusting thee to guide me. Tell me this. When you read these stories of Joseph's God, yes, I didn't say Joseph. When you read these stories of Joseph's God, and how surely he dealt with Joseph, do you not think that there is a God we can trust? The God who spared not even his own son, but delivered him up to the death of the cross for us and for our salvation. Oh, I don't know about you. I don't claim to have all that strong a faith. But I am wanting to sing, I am trusting thee, Lord Jesus, trusting only thee. Let's sing that in our closing hymn.